Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 76. This is Jamie Russo. I own a coworking space in Palo Alto, California. I'm the executive director of the Global Workspace Association and the host of the Everything Coworking Podcast. Quick note, if you've been thinking about signing up for the Coworking Startup School program, this is your chance to snag a spot as the next cohort kicks off its live virtual event on Thursday, May 24th, which is next week. Crazy to believe. So if you want more details, head over to www.coworkingstartupschool.com to get more details and make sure you don't miss out on this session. I love today's interview. It's a shift from my fairly practical and tactical recent episodes. I introduce Anthony, my guest, as I get into the interview, so I won't do that here. But put your thinking cap on and get ready to go big picture. Enjoy.
Thank you for tuning in. You are really going to enjoy today's guest. He's the keynote speaker for the 2018 Flex Office Conference hosted by the Global Workspace Association and NAOP. The conference is September 12th through 14th in Austin, Texas. If you are in the shared workspace industry, this is a do not miss event. Attending the conference can help you stay on top of quickly evolving industry trends. And it's an opportunity to make connections and build relationships well beyond what you can accomplish through social media. So we hope to see you there, and we thought we'd talk to Anthony today to give you a sense of what you can expect at the conference. And I'll link to the conference details in the show notes. So back to our guest for today. Anthony has been developing online services and products within the commercial real estate sector since 1995. Which is like when the internet started, when he launched the first commercial property website in the UK. For 12 years, he designed, developed, and hosted the UK and European websites for a major real estate advisor, and in 2001, launched the property management and tenant engagement platform Vicinity.com as a joint venture with the second largest REIT in the UK. Today, Anthony runs the office research site cityoffices.net, the SaaS software company, glassnost21.com, and consults widely on how technology is impacting real estate and the digital strategies needed to adjust to this market, some of which we're going to talk about today. If you want to find him online, he tweets at Anthony Slumbers, and he blogs at anthonyslumbers.com. You can find him on LinkedIn, where he tends to post his blogs as well. And he writes a technology and real estate column for Estates Gazette. And I will put all those links in the show notes so you can find him. But Anthony is joining us from London today. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I'm super excited. I mean, you have a unique vantage point to the folks that I typically have on the podcast, and you're in the UK, and Americans love a British accent. So that'll be fun. But I'd love to have you share your background. You know, it's been deeply entrenched in IT and real estate. Talk about kind of how that has evolved over time, and sort of how your experience has shaped your perspective on space as a service. Anthony has a post on LinkedIn. It's a little bit older now. I'll link to it in the show notes, but I loved it and thought it was just a dead-on perspective on kind of what's happening in the space now. So I'm super excited that he's joining us for the conference and, of course, today. So, Anthony, I'll shut up and let you kind of tell us about you and your background and your perspective on the industry.
No, that's great. Thank you. Well, you covered a lot of the sort of history of what I've done. What's quite interesting, the way I look at things now is having sort of started, you said, you know, started in 1995, pretty much when the internet started, where it was when the web started. And believe it or not, back in those days, the entire HTML specification, so everything you could actually do in a web browser, was only about 34 sides of A4. So rather amazingly, you could actually just learn all this stuff from scratch. So the sort of first 5 years of the internet was sort of incredibly exciting because it was just moving so fast, and every day there'd be stuff new. It was very much of the the famous S-curve in business, where you start with innovation, move through products, and then eventually becomes commoditized. Well, when I started, it was very much at the sort of bottom left of the S-curve, all the sort of very innovative things. And that's all went on till, as you know, sort of 2000, and all went absolutely crazy, and the dot-com bubble blew up and all that sort of stuff. And that sort of, you know, shut everyone up for a while, as it were. But interestingly, in 2001, when I started Vicinity, which is this tenant engagement platform, but also a suite of property management tools, the way of looking at things then was very much to what I now criticize, but was very much the thing to do in those days, which was to digitize the past. So you had a business that worked in X way, but it was all in paper. How can we make all that digital? And that's essentially what we did building Vicinity and the management tools. We took what was there and put them on a browser, and that all worked really, really well for, you know, 10 years on after that. And then you've got this sort of move to, you know, 2007 iPhone came out, and that really was a sort of, you know, the evolutionists would call it a punctured equilibrium, that the progress was no longer linear, it was something much more dramatic. And that sort of completely changed the world. And pretty much everything I'd done up until that time, and actually really probably up until 2010, because it took good, we forget it now, but for the first couple of years, the iPhone didn't go anywhere. And it was really 3 or 4 years after it came out that it really sort of took off. But it completely changed everything, really, because this whole idea of having what is now a supercomputer in our pocket and broadband becoming ubiquitous suddenly changes the way you look at business, and then because of the way you look at business, the work you're going to do, and then where you're going to do it. And, you know, I'm not quite sure when the earliest co-working type places started, but probably not that far off, 2010, 2000.
Yeah, I mean, sort of the traditional executive suites like a Regus have been around for decades. But here in the States, we cite 2006 as the first co-working space that sort of called itself that in San Francisco. So, right. Yeah, around that time.
Yeah, well, yes. So those were sort of the very early days. But my point is that beginning of 2000, as I said, it was all incredible. 1995 to 2000 was all that really incredible amount of innovation and everything changing all the time. And then it sort of pretty much hit a plateau through till sort of 2010. Then you had more and more people with this supercomputer in their pocket. One of the good things about the dot-com bust was that you'd had so many crazy financings of infrastructure companies that there was actually broadband and fiber all around the world. Tom Friedman's book, "The Earth is the World is Flat," starts by talking about the reason the Indian IT industry got off the ground was because they put in so many fiber cables from America and Europe into India with these companies that subsequently went bust. Yeah. But it ended up that they installed all this infrastructure so they could suddenly move on. But all of a sudden, because you've got all that, I think it has dramatically changed our whole notion of what work is, where work should go. And that's really what has underpinned the whole co-working market. And I think it's just a case of those things are becoming more and more pronounced. That, you know, connectivity is getting faster and faster. Our mobiles are getting more and more powerful. And now you're starting to see the rise of artificial intelligence and machine learning. And it's taking the whole notion of the work we do to another place. And I think that is what is going to shape the way our spaces, our co-working type spaces, evolve over the next few years, as they take into account really new ways of working, as opposed to just doing the past in a digitized way.
Yeah, so you bring up AI, which I love talking about because my brain doesn't sort of, it's only beginning to start thinking, what does that look like? And I was reading, I can't remember if it was one of your blog posts or your tech prop presentation, but just sort of, yeah, that framework for like, how do you think about what AI can do and what types of work gets done and in shared space? And then what does that mean for what space as a service looks like? Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, you sort of your framework for AI and how to think about that? Because I think a lot of us don't think about that yet very often.
The way to think about AI is that if you, this is a very narrow way of looking at it, but it proves the point. The way to think about it is that any task that you do that is structured, repeatable, or predictable is going to be automated. It's only a matter of time. You know, AI sounds terribly clever, but it's still, you know, computers are adding machines. That's what they do. They become very clever adding machines, but essentially that's what they do. They of course have no consciousness. They don't understand. They have no feelings. But they're getting really, really good at doing anything that is structured and repeatable and predictable. So when you start breaking things down like that, you start thinking, well, in that case, move forward a couple of years and think, well, what work are we going to be doing? If most of the work that is structured, repeatable, predictable is going to be done by the machines in some way, what are we humans going to do? Now, the very lucky thing for us, of course, is that humans are really, really good at what computers are really, really bad at. And generally speaking, vice versa. So AI is a very complementary skill. It's a very complementary function if we use it in the right way. Because what humans have, of course, is empathy, imagination, intuition, design, social intelligence, judgment, those sorts of things. What computers are good at are making predictions. I can give you a 60% probability that Anthony will buy this or Anthony will sell that, or 70% prediction that Anthony will turn left. What they won't give you is any sense of judgment. And so you have these machines that are going to help you predict things a lot more, make much easier predictions, what is going to happen next. But it's for us to then say, well, if that's going to happen, in that case, what are we going to do? So there might be five options that we could do. The human skill is looking at those five options and saying, that's the one we should do. The computers just give us options. It's human judgment that is important in deciding what to do with those options. So you have a very different type of space requirement, which I think is the absolutely key thing and why co-working / flexible is, as Google said in a report that came out in 2015, going to be the defining feature of the workplace by 2020. And that is because in a structured, repeatable, predictable type of job, you have to be in a set place at a set time using specified equipment. In a world where all of that is taken away and the important thing is judgment, intuition, design, empathy, social intelligence, etc., you need different types of spaces for that. You need much more spaces that are there to catalyze these human skills rather than just being places where you go and put your computer down. So the opportunity to develop spaces that make the most, that help us make the most of all our human skills, is vast, because I think it's going to be pervasive through pretty much all the work all of us do.
Yeah, I feel like we're really at the beginning of understanding that. I mean, we talk a lot about like activity-based work, but I think, and there's a lot of work that's been done on that concept, but we still see a lot of flexible space, at least here in the States, is sort of defined as like sort of free address or dedicated desk or private space with walls, which has more to do with things like, are you on the phone? Are you working with a team? Versus I think what you are getting at is like, what truly is the type of work that we're doing? And it's not right. We're not so tied. I mean, the machine helps us be able to be where we want to work, but we're not so tied to the machine. We're doing right decision-making and thinking and creative processes. And so what are the environments that support that? And so I feel like we're not very totally sophisticated at that yet, especially in flexible spaces sort of generally. But I think over time that will evolve.
I think that's exactly the point. We're taking and have taken the baby steps, and some of these baby steps are quite big baby steps, but they're still baby steps towards a true space as a service world, where space as a service is a two-dimensional phrase. On one hand, it's just referring to space that you literally can procure as a service. So can I have that space for an hour, a day, a month, a week, whatever?
But really, has actually been a big leap. I mean, just that sort of thing.
Well, that's an absolute huge leap. So that's what I mean. It's a baby step, but that's a big baby step, because it's a foundational one. But when you move on from there, it's not only that I can procure space on as a service basis, but I can procure the space that provides me with the products or services I need to do the task at hand as and when I need it. So as an example, definitely front of envelope example, I need a podcast room. Now, I mean, you laugh about that, but we have quite a decent setup here, so it's sounding all right. But I did a podcast quite recently, which ended up almost unusable because it was in completely the wrong sort of room. So you start thinking of, I'm in this landlord's office building. Now, I don't want to rent a podcast room, because I only need it every now and again, but I sure would pay quite a lot of money for it for an hour or two when I do need it. In the same way, a lot of the activity-based working type spaces, you sort of think that big companies, large companies have the financials and the scale to produce spaces that can provide all the right sort of setting for the type of work I want to do when and where I want to do it. But most companies are not big. And so that, I think, is one of the huge opportunities, that we will all start to need these different types of spaces for different type of work, small group work, large group work, big work, big team work, quiet space, thought space, etc. I think Herman Miller have done a couple of good reports.
They have, yeah.
They get a bit carried away. They come in with about 14 different types of spaces. But you can whittle that down depending on the type of business and the type of area you are. We need, but the potential to be able to use the right sort of tool for the job, and if you're thinking space as a tool, this space helps me do what I need to do on an on-demand basis, I think is extremely, extremely compelling and a huge opportunity. But it's sort of the interesting thing is it goes on to make you think about data, which is what you need to understand the types of spaces that people need. And that's a different area that I think a lot of co-working flexible spaces think of, but maybe don't think of quite hard enough, or don't think through to the conclusion of how much and how well do I need to understand my customers. If I could really understand my customer, could I provide them with better services? So if I understand, I sort of think of it like this, that there's three layers of data that we really need to start understanding. So there's sort of data about your building, how your building operates, and then data about how people move around your building, and then data about the people themselves. And there's sort of lots of lots of layers in there. But if you start really understanding that Anthony likes quiet spaces, always likes quiet spaces in the morning. He likes tea rather than coffee. And right. Don't you dare put it above 18 degrees temperature. Once you start understanding those sorts of things, I think we're going to see the whole market evolving from a position where it knows more than a traditional landlord, who essentially knows nothing about their customers, but still doesn't know anything like it could do, and hasn't really worked through yet. What do I need to know? In what format, and therefore, what could I do with it?
Yeah, and so I get a sense that WeWork is probably the operator working on this, and they don't talk about it a lot, but I run into some folks from their sort of engineering and design groups on panels and things like that. And, you know, they, I don't know if they bought or partnered with a company called Comfy, so they put, I think they have sensors, like basically HVAC sensors that really help people to personalize temperature. But they're really thinking about these things. And it's interesting because their spaces are pretty, I don't know, the ones that I've been in are sort of homogeneous.
Yes.
So it'll be curious to me to see what do they do with this data, because I'm sort of picturing, right, like a future where the workspace is just more diverse because we understand and it's very individualizable, and their spaces are not so much, but they are thinking hard about these things, I think. But then, who else is thinking? What does the relationship look like over time to get to a place where we're measuring the data, we use the data, we're designing for the data? Like, who are the parties that are involved and partnering to make that happen?
There's a number of angles looking at all this. I'm just thinking, going back to the WeWork thing.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of what they've achieved, but the homogeneity of all their spaces is I think going to end up as a bit of an Achilles heel.
It's fundamental to their business model because they just cut up a lot of spaces into sizes that people can use in a pretty dense format, but hard to change.
Well, the densification is the whole point of WeWork, isn't it? Wow. That's the trick to densify all the space. But my feeling is that I have seen photos of spaces around the world that aren't the standard WeWork look. So I might be being a bit unfair here, but I have a feeling that they will end up splitting into different brands. Because I think your type of space, and their type of space was designed originally for essentially freelance techies, wasn't it?
Yep.
That was the freelancers with a technical bent. So freelancers who may happen to do designy things or codey things, all that sort of stuff. So that's very much a, if you like, a persona. Whereas I think you're going to find that people are going to start developing spaces with very particular types involved. Now these might be industries. I mean, I was talking to actually an extremely well known flexible space operator the other day, and we were talking about the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. About, you know, is there a line that you could take and think, right, well, I'm going to develop spaces in the top 20 cities around the world where anyone who's in the fashion industry is going to have to rent space in these places, because it is just going to be where anyone in the industry is going to be completely tailored to the desires, the wants and the needs of that particular industry. And I suspect we're going to see a fair amount of that sort of thing. How niche it breaks down, I don't really know. But one of the data layers that I think we're going to get much better at is we're going to understand our areas in a much more granular detail. You know, what type of company is around us? What is the demographic of the people around us? What is the psychographics of the people around us? What sort of food do they like? What music do they like? Who fits into which compartment? And I think there's huge scope for, as I say, understanding your potential customer in a way that provides the foundation for how we go on and develop our spaces. And we absolutely try and attune them to the wants and needs of particular types. And I think that would work, because the densification thing obviously is important, but I see densification slightly differently. I see densification from a landlord's point of view of thinking, instead of thinking, I'm going to try and let this company 10,000 square feet of space on a 10-year lease, to think, actually, I'm going to let them 5,000 square. I actually would prefer if they took 5,000 square feet on a rolling contract, with the idea that instead of letting them the 10,000 square feet, which then included all these different workspaces that they might need, they reduce, if you like, to a core. And in that core, they might actually take that for a bit longer, and then they buy in extra services. But ultimately, you want somebody who was going to take 10,000 square feet to take 5, but end up spending as much as if they had taken 7. So they're actually paying more, but still making a saving. And you've got the extra space to let. So it's partly the whole notion of people aren't necessarily going to be coming into their office 40 hours a week, five days a week. Is a plus. You don't want people in there all the time. You just want them in there when you can get them in there, and if you have the right services for them, I think you'll be able to charge, you know, significant premiums. But you really have to know your customer for that.
So, who do you think will play the data collector role? Will it be the operator, or like when will the building owner, the landlord, get involved in that data layer?
If I'm talking to landlords, I say to them, they should be doing it.
Right.
If I'm talking to property managers, I say to them, they should be doing it. The party that does it, I say to the larger landlords that they should become operators. Because they say, well, you know, how do we compete with all this sort of, you know, co-working stuff? Because, you know, they really don't want to, but they're sort of being forced into it. Now, I think landlords have a real problem, because they could, if you're a landlord of a large building, obviously ideally you want a powerful occupier with a strong covenant on a long lease, but tough, you're not likely to get them. Or they're getting rarer and rarer. So what do you do? They're demanding flexible space of some description. Well, you could just outsource it, but then as the whole operator angle moves up the value tree, you could be realizing you're actually losing a lot of money on the table. Or you could try and become a full-on service provider yourself. And the trouble with that is landlords are very much product companies. They sell they build a product and then they lease it. They're not really service companies. Some of them, I think, will manage to transform themselves into service companies, but I think it's such a culturally, organizationally, financially different beast, it's going to be very hard. Or the third alternative, which is probably the way that co-working operators should be thinking, is that from a landlord's point of view, their best option would be to partner very closely with an ecosystem of third parties that would enable them to build a user experience, a new brand in their name. So they would need it. I don't think it makes a very successful adversarial relationship. You don't want a typical, oh well, it's I need a contractor to build my building. Who's going to build it for me cheapest? Yeah. You actually need a real strong partnership where you need to work together and think, right, well, we have this building now. The only way we're going to maximize the value of this building is to create a user experience for everyone who comes into this building that is so premium that it will be very highly, will have very high utilization as a building in total, and people will pay a premium to be in there. How do we do that? How do we build this user experience? How do we build this brand that's going to attract people? And you need a whole range of skills in there. So I think about it that at the top, there's this entity, which could be the landlord, could be a property manager, could be a co-working operator. But essentially, it's the operator. But it's the operator has to have a complete range of skills where they're the ones who say, you know, I am the curator of this user experience. Now, to create this user experience, I need to understand the building. I need to understand the people. I need to understand how they use the building. And I need to understand hospitality. I need to understand workplace design. I need to understand data. There's a whole range of new skills, but I think it's such a powerful position to be looking for, because if this notion of companies needing more activity-based workplaces where they need a workplace that makes their staff as productive as possible, because ultimately no company wants an office, they want a productive workforce. So how do you help me make my workforce productive? Now, in this new non-structured, non-predictable, non-repeatable world, optimizing a workspace is more complicated. And so most companies will not have the skills or the inclination, because they've got their own businesses to run, to try and build workplaces that are optimized for their staff and their businesses. So if they can go to someone who will say, I will solve that for you. Give me your 5 staff, your 50 staff, your 500 staff, I will sort your whole place out for you. And that entity that has all those skills I referred to goes way up the value chain, because without them, the landlord can't really create can't maximize the value of their assets. So the operator, so say take it as the co-working operator, co-working is going to expand as in terms of meaning over the next few years. It means one thing now, in 5 years' time, it'll mean something different. But it will, I think it'll start meaning a multitude of things, lots of different types. But it's going to be such a skill to be able to manage those spaces and curate them to create a great user experience. So the company that can create this user experience will, I think, have huge value. I will say the formula is the UX equals the brand, and the brand will equal the value. So someone's got to create that user experience in the first place, which is frankly the huge opportunity for the whole co-working sector.
Yeah, I'm taking notes because...
Sorry, I was going on a bit there.
It's good, though, and this is exactly why I advocate people come to conferences, because it's not often that we get to sort of step out and think, what is next, and what does this mean, and what... I'm thinking a lot about that skill set. I mean, I kind of brought it up earlier, saying like, I think we're at the early stages, but we really... you sort of took that a step further, just really thinking about, now, like these days, an operator puts space together and sort of decides product mix and kind of has to figure out, what tech to use to run the space. But it's just going to be, all those things will be sort of exponential. I mean, when you talk about the skill set that operators will need to sort of play in that space and to deliver that UX. I mean, we're, you know, most are just not there yet, and but need to see it coming and think through what does that look like and how do we put that all together. And I think to your point, the relationship with the landlord, because it's their asset and you're creating something of value, but for the operators to do to deliver the user experience and also come to the table with all the capital is challenging. Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of the reason, you know, the GWA partners with NAOP on this conference is because we see the future as those, you know, two sides kind of coming together and creating the future. But
absolutely. I mean, this is very, very much what I'm planning to cover in the talk in the, at the event, because you can, you know, it's quite hard to take it all in a short little session like that, but I was planning to expand on that and highlight there's a thread that goes through the whole thing, and sort of so my talk is hopefully will illuminate what that thread is, where what direction that thread's moving in, and hopefully enunciate a set of principles and a way of thinking to approach an opportunity which I suspect is possibly much bigger, mm-hmm. or potentially much bigger than a lot of people realize, especially because, and as I said, if what I'm saying is right about the machines taking away everything structured and repeatable and predictable, there is a whole world of new products and new services that is going to enable, because we've not only got this supercomputer in our pocket, we've got like an X10 supercomputer to help us to augment all our natural skills. And so we haven't really started in terms of where we can go and the quality of service we can make mainstream. That's what I think so much. If you think of the Luddite fallacy of, you know, there's only a certain amount of work to go around, is sort of assuming that there's only a certain number of people who can have the best and everyone else has to put up with what they put up with. Yep. I look at it around the other way, that I see all these technologies as a way of enabling us to think we can all have the best. We can all have the best legal advice. We can all have the best accounting advice. We can all have the best teaching. We can all have the best marketing. We can all have the best products. We can all have the best service. Why not? That's the whole point. Yep. We're trying to make everyone better off, and if these tools and the spaces we create that allow people to really maximize the use of these tools are there, the pie is absolutely enormous. There's really no limit to it. And until everyone has the best of everything, well, I don't think we've ever got to worry about there not being any work to do.
Right. That's a great quote. You had a lot of good sound bites, actually. Yeah, and maybe we'll wrap it up there so that folks will be intrigued to come and hear more at the conference. And I feel like we might have to do a breakout session, because I think this is going to just spark a lot of conversation. So I appreciate you. I mean, you have a neat, unique perspective on sort of the industry, given your background and your experience and what you see. And I think you've given us an exciting glimpse into the future, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more of that.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hoping to open up 100 rabbit holes, which we can have a nice dive down when we're there.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. Well, Anthony, thank you for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you in person in September.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.